time for us to begin our study, if you would please open your Bibles to Acts chapter 23. Acts chapter 23. James is back in the back, or I would ask him to bring us up to speed. He's back there smiling. He knows he's back there in the back, so I can ask him to participate in class. And anyway, in our study, we have read of the Apostle Paul coming into the city of Jerusalem. We know that as he was about to come into the city of Jerusalem, he was warned about the things that were going to happen to him while he was there, that he would be bound, he would become a prisoner, and shameful things would be done. And certainly we saw that occur in Acts chapter 21. And then we saw him making his defense before the Jewish people in Acts chapter 22, and then before the Jewish court in Acts chapter 23, before Felix in Acts 24, before Festus in Acts 25, and then before King Agrippa in Acts chapter 26. Now, I've asked you to really work on remembering that sequence because it will be helpful to you in your study of the Bible and your efforts to try to teach others what the Bible has to say about this time of imprisonment of the Apostle Paul. But what we want to note is that Paul is making his defense in this instance before the Jewish court. And in this instance before the Jewish court, he has been rescued in Acts chapter 21. Arrested by whom? Claudius Lysias. Claudius Lysias is with him in Acts 22, and Claudius Lysias rescues him again in Acts chapter 23. As we notice in this context, to prevent him from being torn apart by the Jewish court. Now, it's difficult to imagine that a court system would allow themselves, as the hierarchy among the Jews, to become so disorderly that someone would have to rescue a prisoner from them for the prisoner's safety. But that's what takes place here. Well, I want to start a study this morning, kind of in the middle of things, where the apostle is in jail in the city of Jerusalem. And there, beginning in verse 12 of this text, it says, "And when it was day, the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 that made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves under a great curse, to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now therefore do ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you as though ye would judge of his case more exactly. And we, before he comes near, are ready to slay him.'" I want to note two or three things in that portion of the text. Number one is we see, obviously, a conspiracy, an agreement together, or an attempted agreement together, between this band of people that are intended to kill Paul, also involving the court, and their intention is to involve this chief captain, who is a soldier in charge of keeping peace among the Jews, also in charge of 1,000 soldiers that were under him. So when you look at this conspiracy, you're seeing some mighty important figureheads that are involved in this attempted murder on the life of the Apostle Paul. And I also want to call your attention to the deceit involved in this. He said, "Do ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down to you as though we would judge, or ye rather, would judge his case more exactly, and we, before he comes near, are ready to slay him." Now, when you look at that, there's a contrast, obviously, between ye and thou in verses 15 and in verse 20, as you'll drop on down just a little bit further. But the intent is to involve this Jewish court in this plot to kill Paul. Now, in verse 16, of this text, it tells us, "But Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, and he came and entered into the castle and told Paul. And Paul called unto him one of the centurions and said, 'Bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath something to tell him.' So he took him and brought him unto the chief captain, and saith, Paul the prisoner called me unto him, and asked me to bring this young man unto thee, who has something to say to thee. And the chief captain took him by the hand, and going aside, asked him privately, What is it that thou hast to tell me? And he said, The Jews have agreed to ask thee to bring down Paul tomorrow unto the council, as though thou wouldest inquire somewhat more exactly concerning him. Do not thou therefore yield unto them, for they're lying wait for him of them more than 40 men who have bound themselves under a curse that they neither to eat nor to drink till they have slain him, and now they are ready, looking for the promise from thee. Now, again, you see what we described in our last study as somewhat of a narrative in this context of the events that are taking place. And the council, the Sanhedrin court, they know about it. We know that now Paul's nephew, his sister's son, somehow has learned about it. We don't know how old he is. But by the way, this is the only mention in the book of Acts of Paul's family. We know from this that he had kinsmen that were living evidently nearby. We know that he had kinsmen, according to the Roman letter, that were living actually in Rome. But we also know that Paul's sister's son had availability to Paul. Now, we might raise a question just here. How come? Paul is being kept securely, obviously, for his own safety. How is it that Paul's sister's son would have access to him? Their jail system was a little different from ours.
It was more of a private jail system. The way that you existed was determined by how many of your friends or relatives would bring you food or clothing or things like that.
You mean it wasn't supplied?
It wasn't.
Wasn't that the government's expense that you ate and all this kind? No, friends and family were expected to bring the things that you would need. So Paul's sister's son obviously had access to Paul for those purposes. But he's learned of this plot, and he makes it known to the chief captain. And you'll also note that this chief captain knows that Paul is a Roman citizen. Now, what's the chief captain's responsibility? Keep him safe. That's right. Now, you remember earlier that the chief captain nearly messed up. In fact, he did mess up. What did he do when he arrested Paul?
Bound him, got ready
to have him scourged. That's right. Now, we're going to talk about that in a little bit from this text on down just a little bit further. But what we want to know here is he knows well who Paul is. He knows what his rights and privileges are. And he knows that it's his responsibility to preserve those rights and privileges as a Roman citizen.
I just find it interesting that if the Sanhedrin seems so willing to let these thugs kill Paul, they felt pretty sure that they had no legal recourse, and that even if they took Paul to trial, it would be wrong and that he wouldn't necessarily be convicted.
Well, true. Yeah, and we call these thugs, and that's really what they were, but you know, thugs can be anywhere on the social ladder. The role that these men had, it was enough to bring them into contact with the court with full expectation of the compliance of the court in this plot. But be that as it may, this fellow, Paul's nephew, he reports to the chief captain exactly what he's learned, and the chief captain makes preparation to preserve Paul's life. Now, we have mentioned this before, that the chief captain has saved Paul's life in Acts 21, Acts 22, and now in Acts 23, there in verse 10, and now again in verses 19 through 23. This chief captain becomes an important character to the Apostle Paul. Can someone tell me why? I said this chief captain becomes an important character to the Apostle Paul. Can somebody tell me why? Pardon me?
Besides saving.
Well, no, not necessarily besides saving. That's the key. But I want to call your attention to Romans, the 15th chapter, and the sequence of events. Remember our map? Where Paul has been, where he is when he writes the book of Romans. Where is he when he writes Romans? He's in Corinth, that's right. And where is he going? To Jerusalem. And then what happens to him there? Bad things start to happen. And he knew that this was going to happen. And Paul said that he did not hold his life dear as of any account unto himself. He's determined to go anyway, to go preach. But in Romans, the 15th chapter, now this is a real important chapter. Those of you who are in our authority class, by the way, we're going to meet at our house tonight in our authority study. Same time, same topic, everything, but at our house. Because Dave and Eve are out of town. So be that as it may. Another point. Going back to Romans 15, this is an important passage to that study as well as to this study, the book of Acts. Okay? When you get the sequence of events in your mind, you don't want to forget the place of Romans 15. Written from Corinth to saints in Rome. All as Paul is on his way to Jerusalem, bad things about to happen, but going with the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, with that in mind, and that timeline in mind, as he writes to the Romans, he says in verse 25 of Romans 15, "But now I say, I go unto Jerusalem, ministering unto the saints. For it had been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution to the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. Yea, it had been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles had been made partakers of their spiritual things, they owe it to them also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have accomplished this, I have sealed and have sealed to them this fruit, I will go on by you unto Spain. And I know that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessings of Christ," or blessing of Christ. Paul's right there. And no, Paul's anticipation is that he will go from Jerusalem, come back through Rome on his way to Spain. That's his plan. But then in verse 30 it says, "Now I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ, and by the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea, and that my ministration which I have for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come unto you in joy through the will of God, and together with you find rest. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen." Now, having read that, look back carefully at verse 30. Paul's desire is, he's begging them, "I beseech you." He said that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me. For what? What does he want them to pray for him for? His safety, number one, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea. He wants to be delivered from those that are disobedient in Judea. Does Paul anticipate bad things might happen? Later, does he know bad things are going to happen before he gets there? Yes, he knows that. Going anyway. He calls upon these in Rome to pray that he can be delivered from those who are disobedient in Judea. Now, in relation to our study in our authority class, the point that we're pulling from this is that he's going to the city of Jerusalem to minister unto the saints, this collection that has been collected from Macedonia and Achaia. But we also noted, and are going to note in that study, that his this contribution that he has for Jerusalem might be accepted of the saints. Now, why was there a concern about that? All right, we've got a collection from Gentiles, which you'll note back in verse 27, and it's for those who are Jews in Jerusalem, the needy among the saints, Jews in Jerusalem. And if you'll notice further in this text, he desires then that he may be able to come to them in joy through the will of God, and together with you find rest. He anticipates being freed from this captivity, or at least have the privilege to be among those who are saints in Rome and be at peace. Now, where does Claudius Lysias fit into this equation? All right, keeping him safe. You think the prayers of the saints in Rome were answered? I tell you, brethren, I think sometimes we underestimate the value of this illustration. This is an important illustration. This chief captain has a great responsibility, but here God uses this man through his providence, not a miracle to take place, but through his providence he takes care of the Apostle Paul. I'm convinced that these brethren, their prayers meant something. God heard them, and Paul did come to those in Rome, and when he was there, obviously he was in peace, as it were, but he came how? In chains. That's right. He came as a Roman prisoner to the city of Rome. Now, Paul has taken the necessary precautions that he might be delivered from this plot by these who are Jews. You'll note now the efforts of Claudius Lysias. Look, if you will, now beginning in verse 22. Claudius Lysias. So the chief captain let the young man go, charging him, tell no man that thou hast signified these things to me. Now, were there corrupt officers among those who were Roman soldiers? Was there corruption among the Roman soldiers? Was it quite common? Do you see corruption that exists here in the Roman court, or the Jewish court, rather? Well, we see there's a problem there. But among the whole host of corrupt officials that were Roman soldiers and corrupt civil servants, as it were, in the Jewish court, do we find a good man who's a soldier, who's in the place to help Paul? Yeah, we do. We do. We find a man who's responsible. We find a man who has under his charge 1,000 soldiers. And we find a man who sees himself as accountable for the life of Paul. And we want to note that. We live in a wicked world. And we live in a world where corruption exists on every hand. Corruption may exist in civil servants. It may exist among policemen. It may exist among civil authorities. It may exist among courts and judges and that sort of thing. But in and amongst it all, we don't need to paint everybody with the same brush and say that everybody's corrupt because they weren't here. Here is a man who was responsible enough to take his position, serious enough to make these provisions to keep Paul safe. Now I want you to look at it. Now this is a result of the prayers of these brethren. Look what this man did. Acts chapter 23, beginning at verse 22. So the chief captain, that's Claudius Lysias, let the young man go, charging him, tell no man that thou hast signified these things to me. Now I want to ask you a question. Right now, only Paul's nephew and now this soldier know about this plot that are in the position to do anything to help Paul, and Paul's nephew is now told, don't tell anybody. What's Claudius Lysias doing? Here's a Roman soldier by himself. What's he doing? He's going to foil the plan, that's right. But he takes upon himself the sole responsibility. Don't tell anybody else. I'm going to take care of this. Now, again, I want to underscore, out of a lot of corrupt people, here was a man that's trying to do right.
And it's also easy to paint him with the broad brush of the fact that he was a Gentile, and hence ungodly. But you've also got Cornelius in Caesarea, and there was also the individual, I think he was also a centurion that came to Jesus asking him to heal a servant.
Yes, yes. So we do have some.
There were some who had what we would call a good heart.
That's right.
On the other hand, to be completely honest, Claudius Lysias is very much aware of the fact that he came this close
yes.
to terminating his career very early.
Yes.
And he's going to make sure that doesn't happen.
That's right. We'll address that more when we get to his letter. Carolyn, then Bruce.
Talking about answers to prayer, oftentimes we have one thing in mind, how we envision that God can make a certain thing happen. And, you know, it seems like 9 times out of 10, God has a completely different way that things are going to come about. And better to protect Paul than he kind of like has a free trip to Rome with a personal bodyguard, if you want to look at it that way, as it turned out. And we don't know Paul's thoughts, but if I were Paul, I don't think I would have envisioned that as the way I would get to Rome safely.
I would not think so, no. But here is a responsible man that's in the position to help Paul, and he does. And we want to note how he does it. Look at verse 23. Acts 23:23. It says, "And he called unto him two of the centurions, and said, Make ready 200 soldiers to go as far as Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night."
So you should change 300 horsemen to 70
horsemen. Yeah, I probably should. All right, we'll change that to 70, but we won't do it right this minute. So that should be 70 horsemen. That's not correct. So we've got a total of 470. You do the math on that, that won't come up to 470 people. 470 people. So we've got 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen, 470 men. And they're leaving, the text tells us, the third hour of the night. What time is it?
9 o'clock
p.m., 9 o'clock at night. And notice, if you will, where is he taking you? To Caesarea. Where is he currently?
Jerusalem.
How far from Jerusalem to Caesarea? About 65 miles. Now, 65 miles to you wouldn't be much, would it? You might think if you had a man that you were charged with his safety, you'd put him in some kind of police car or an armored vehicle and just drive him down there. But they didn't have that means of transportation then. So he gets these people together. He calls two centurions. Now, how many soldiers does a centurion have oversight of? 200. That's right. Now, he gives order to them to take care of this. So we've got 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, 70 horsemen. Okay? And he gets these folks together. Now, in verse 24, "And he bade them provide beasts that they might set Paul thereon and bring him safe to Felix the governor." 470 men. You think that you could protect one man with 470 men? Well, you'd like to think perhaps you could handle that. But that's what this man does. 40 that took the vow, and he's got 470 that's going to try to safely secure Paul in Caesarea. Now, in order to make this thing work, it tells us that he wanted to bring him safe to Felix, the governor. Now, we'll talk more about Felix when we get a little further along. Felix was a corrupt man. He was just very height of corruption, ungodly, immoral man. But nonetheless, you see what Claudius Lysias is attempting to do. He's following protocol. He has arrested Paul, not knowing exactly what the problem is. He's delivered him to the Jewish court to try to ascertain what the problem is. The Jewish court's all torn apart, so that doesn't work. So he rescues Paul again, puts him back in prison, finds out that there's a plot involving the court to try to kill Paul, and now the next step in protocol would be taking to the Roman governor, whose name was Felix. And so that's what he's attempting to do. That's part of his job now, to protect Paul. Now, in order to do that, he wrote a letter, verse 25. And it says that this letter was after this form. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix, greeting. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be slain of them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And desiring to know the cause wherefore they accuse him, I brought him down to their council, whom I found to be accused about questions of the law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when it was shown to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to thee forthwith, charging his accusers also to speak against him before thee. Now that's just a real interesting letter, isn't it? If you'll note, he said, this man was seized by the Jews and was about to be slain of them. Now we can read about some of that in Acts chapter 21. But you'll notice in Acts 23, he said, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Now, was that so? No, that was not so. What did Claudius Lysias leave out of his letter?
That he was about to
have. That he was about to beat him with a scourge because he did not know that he was a Roman. And Paul raised that question, and when it was learned that in Acts 22 that Paul, in fact, was a Roman citizen, Claudius Lysias feared for his own life. Now, I want to underscore that. Why did he fear for his own life?
He feared for his own life because you weren't supposed to do these things to a Roman citizen until after he had a fair trial and been convicted.
All right, so Claudius Lysias kind of missed it here. His letter is a little bit tweaked.
He sort of got things out of order, probably made a mistake there in dictating it to the secretary.
Right.
Well, likely so. Yeah, no, I don't think so. He's
left out a few things.
He's just left out a few things to make his letter appear a little nicer, a little more flattering to him, so to speak. But you'll notice he said in verse 29, I took him to their council, and I found him to be accused about questions of their law. Well, now, was that exactly true? Questions about the law, that is, the law of the Jews. Was that exactly true?
Perhaps, as far as you know.
Perhaps. I'm going to give that a kind of a slash. Perhaps. Because what he has seen is that there is a dispute in the court itself, not necessarily an accusation against Paul, but a dispute in the court itself relative to the resurrection of the dead. So this dispute was not necessarily with Paul. Paul extracted all he could get from that dispute, identifying himself a Pharisee, and rightly so, he was a Pharisee. But when we look at the teaching of the Apostle Paul, Paul preached that there was indeed a resurrection and that the message that he had received was indeed from God. And so these were things that the Sadducees did not believe. And so Paul, as it were, milked that just a little bit. Now, if you go back to Acts chapter 24, or go forward to Acts chapter 24, I want to call your attention to verse 7. Acts chapter 24, in verse 7. In this text, it tells us, verse 7 is a footnote, it says, but the chief captain Lysias came, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come before thee. Well, now, Claudius Lysias, when he did arrest Paul, was that true that he took him? Because they were about to tear him apart. Yeah, that's what he did. That's what he did. Now, Claudius Lysias, like I said, I don't want to leave this without being underscored. He's doing his job as a military leader to provide for the security of the Apostle Paul, because indeed he was a Roman citizen. Now, most of all of this we've already talked about. All right? Any questions or comments just here?
Essentially, verse 6, Okay.
Chapter 4 in chapter 24.
Okay.
They kind of confirm this aspect of we wanted to try him according to our law.
Yeah, and they did. Yeah. Yeah. That's their slant
right on
this story. Yeah, we want to try according to our law. And of course, he would have stood how many chances of survival? Probably none. Bruce, I'm sorry, I missed you a lot, though.
Well, I was trying to say, throughout all this, Claudius Lysias is basically protecting himself.
Yes, he is doing that.
Because if Felix really knew what was going on, then he would, you know, be hugged or whatever because of his wrongdoing.
Well, that's right. One of the things I want to note with you, too, is that in verse 29 of our text, Acts 23, verse 29, he said, "Whom I found to be accused about questions of their law, but to have done to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds." Claudius Lysias, in his letter, makes it very clear that Paul has not been accused of violating Roman law. Whatever accusations are derived, it's questions concerning their law. And as I said, I put a slant on that it was because of this court that was divided and Claudius Lysias trying to rescue him. Now, in verse 30, it says, "When it was shown to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to thee forthwith, charging his accusers also to speak against him before thee." Now, underscore that again in your thinking, because as we turn over to the 24th chapter, it was the intention of Claudius Lysias to just simply move this thing out of the hands of the Jews and their court into the hands of Felix, who represented the Roman court. And so we want to see that as a distinction. This man is following protocol, as he should, to provide for the safety of the Apostle Paul. Any questions or comments just here? Yeah. Vicki?
And then Karen. However much Claudius Lysias may have colored things in his favor, certainly the high priest Ananias and these elders were coloring things in their favor simply by saying that in verse 7 of chapter 24, Lysias the commander came along. That was true. But then, and with much violence, took him out of our hands. I mean,
he just arrested him.
They are really painting that brush.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
The brush the way they want it.
Isn't that interesting? When we think about politics, it's not a thing new, is it? Things are tilted and slanted in the favor of the one that's making the argument. So that's not anything new. And that's what took place here. So we want to take note of that. That's nothing new about it. That's kind of always been. Now, if you'll drop down to verse 31 of our text, we'll read the rest of the chapter. It says, "So the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris." Now look on your map and see where that is. We're still about 30 miles from the destination. The caravan, as we have on the board, leaves Jerusalem at night and makes it to Antipatris, located about 30 miles north of Jerusalem towards Caesarea. So we've still got some distance to go to get Paul to where he's going in Caesarea. But traveling this distance and traveling it at night with how many soldiers? 470 soldiers, okay? It's not necessary now for 470 soldiers to go the whole rest of the trip on with Paul to Caesarea. He's out of danger for the most part at this point. And so you'll note that many of these soldiers return. The text tells us in verse 32, "But on the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the castle." So now how many folks we got going onward with Paul? 70 soldiers are going onward with Paul, and the rest go back to the city of Jerusalem. So, here we are. We've got about 25 miles or so that Paul has yet to go to reach his destination. Now, in verse 33, And they, when they came to Caesarea, delivered the letter to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when he had read it, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear thee fully, said he, when thine accusers also are come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's palace. Now that would be the judgment hall, as it were. I want to call to your attention as well as we're looking at this that Felix, as corrupt as we're going to talk about his life was, and as corrupt as his governorship was, he's following protocol. Here's the plan. I will hear his case when his accusers come from Jerusalem. Now, he raises the question, where's Paul from? Why would he say that?
He's in his jurisdiction.
That's right. Do I have jurisdiction over this matter? That's a simple yes or no kind of question. So, yes, he has jurisdiction over this matter. And so when his accusers are here, we will proceed further with this case. And so Paul is put in prison. Now, one of the interesting things just here is a fellow can stay in prison a long time waiting for somebody to come and accuse him. How long could somebody stay in prison waiting? According to law, 2 years. Yeah. You can stay in prison 2 years waiting for your accusers. Now, here he is in Caesarea, and he's appearing before Felix. And Felix was an official for only an appointed period of time. He wasn't going to always be the governor in Caesarea. And we'll look at that when we get to the 24th chapter. But what we want to note just here is that Felix has a period of time to do something about this. And he does nothing. And in order to please the Jews, when he leaves his office and Festus is appointed, what does he do with Paul? Leaves him in prison. Now, he had the authority to do something about it, but he didn't do anything about it. His service is over, and he goes on his merry way. And now Festus is the governor. He just leaves Paul in prison, waiting for some accuser to come. Now, keep in mind, when we get over to the 24th and 25th chapters, we're going to talk about how that Paul had the authority as a Roman citizen to demand that judgment be made. And if you're not going to make it, then what?
Let me go.
Pardon me?
Let me go.
Let me go. Or? I'm going to appeal my case to Caesar. You've got the authority to let me go. If you're not going to do it, then we'll just have to take it the next notch up. We'll go to Caesar.
Clarification, I wasn't sure what you just said, but the accusers did come, didn't they, at the beginning of 24?
Yes, Tertullian is their representative. Yes.
Ananias and some elders.
Yes, yes, yes.
So he had been accused, but then sat there for another...
Essentially, a judgment has not been made. Now, when he goes to Rome, where's his accusers? Yeah, so they don't follow to Rome. So when Paul is there for 2 years, he's allowed to be released. But then he's in prison again in Rome. This whole ordeal, we're going to throw this number out, and you do some work on it on your own. And in my studies, I've tried to put together just an estimate of how long this thing took Paul. And from what I've determined, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 or 5 years from the time that Paul was arrested in the city of Jerusalem to the time that he was released from Rome. Now, he was in prison in Jerusalem, he was in prison in Caesarea, he was in prison in Rome during that time. And of course, much of that time was consumed with the travel to the city of Rome where this was to take place. And the shipwreck and all of that was involved. Now, we think that we have judicial problems that seem to take a long time to resolve in the courts. That's not anything new either. Here it took Paul 5 years to finally get this thing resolved in the courts. So 5 years, a long time out of the fellow's life. And much of this time, well, this time was all in prison. He didn't have freedom during any of this. So we want to take note of that. Now, so he's on his way. Now, look, if you will, at our map just here. I thought I'd place this on here. Here's Jerusalem, and we've got Caesarea almost, well, a little over halfway to the city of Ptolemais. And, of course, then he goes to Tyre and so forth. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what we want to notice with the location of these places, 400 soldiers left Jerusalem and 70 deliver him when he arrives in the city of Caesarea. Okay, any questions?
Just as a sort of a footnote here, that this is not really explaining anything. I think Antipatris should be a little bit further north.
Perhaps so.
More like halfway.
Yeah, I think I pointed at Ptolemais, but Antipatris is here.
But anyway, Antipatris is where in 1 Samuel, when the Ark of the Covenant was lost to the Philistines, the Battle of Ebenezer was essentially right there. The Philistines camped at Aphek, which is now Antipatris.
Yeah.
And so it was the point here is all of these places, and this, all of these are not stories, are not in a vacuum somewhere.
Well, that's right.
There's a lot of history and all these things.
That's right, and this map doesn't show correctly the topography of the land either. We know that Jerusalem was up on the mountain and about 3,000 feet thereabouts elevation. And of course, now we're going down. Here is the coastal plains. So Antipatris would be in the coastal plains area.
Right.
So it would be a populated area for the most part. Of course, Caesarea was a man-made seaport in honor of Caesar, as you see dictated in his name. All right, so Cilicia was an imperial province and thus under the jurisdiction of Felix, as Richard pointed out to us. And here we are with Paul on his way. Okay?
I think it also makes sense that what Claudius Lysias did was to send the foot soldiers halfway and then have them come back that night. These 40 men were not going to be able to launch any kind of an attack on Paul that far away from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
They were going to do it, it would be somewhere around Jerusalem.
Well, that's right. Yeah, this is an assassination plot, and it has been foiled because Claudius Lysias isn't playing ball. He's doing his job.
Right.
He's not cooperating with the court. So this is all out of order.
From a tactical standpoint.
Yeah, from a tactical standpoint.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So here we are. He's got him delivered. And here's our conclusion. So he's keeping him in Caesarea until his accusers come in Herod's palace. Now, yes?
Just, as we start the class, it dawns on me, you know, verse 11, everything that's happening is by the will of God.
Right.
That God has already told Paul, you're going to Rome.
Right.
But yet, all of the people that had to play a part in this, and I was just thinking about Paul's nephew, who found out about this. And what if Paul's nephew hadn't said anything?
Yeah.
And I thought about the connection, kind of a similarity between Paul's nephew and Queen Esther. And the fact that both of them found out about things that they had to raise to another level. Mordecai had told Queen Esther, again, if you don't say something, again, deliverance will come, but you'll be accountable for this. And similar here, kind of Paul's nephew, God was going to make sure Paul got there.
Yeah.
But Paul's nephew had that opportunity. He knew something. And it was his responsibility to say something. And, you know, again, I just think there's a point that when we know something, we've got to say it.
We've got to say it, yes. And that's right.
Real quick, ask the question, where was Paul just before he went to Jerusalem?
Well, he had been in Corinth, and of course he was bumping down the coast.
Before.
Well, he'd been in this area, Caesarea.
He'd been to Caesarea, and he'd spent a little bit of time there.
Yeah.
And so, Philip's going to be here. We don't know if the centurion, Claudius, Cornelius. There.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are several Christians.
There are Christians in Caesarea. That's right. That's right. That can supply his needs. He's been with them. Now, I want to ping on that point at this point as well, Chris, that you've just made. You know, sometimes there are problems that we face in our lives, and we don't always know how it's going to work out, but God does. And we pray about it, which Paul did, and he called upon others to pray for him on a number of occasions, and on this occasion, specifically on this occasion. Now, I doubt that the Apostle Paul knew all that was in the mind of God, how God was going to prepare this thing to come out, but he trusted God. It's going to work out. He knew that he was going to Rome somehow. Perhaps he didn't know he was going as a prisoner, but God had already told him he was going to Rome, and that opportunities would be there. And so,
yeah, trust. 27:25 kind of indicates this whole latitude all along.
Yeah. This is the way it's going to be. And so it's time to trust that this is what's going to happen. We pray about it. We talk about it. We tell all we can do and keep in mind on this. Paul did his part. He went to Jerusalem and he preached. He knew that it was going to take courage. And he said, I'm going to be down there preaching. And if they kill me, they kill me. That's the way it is. But pray for me and that God will deliver me. And God delivered him. And notice, if you will, please, too, that not only did it involve his preaching, Paul appealed to his Roman citizenship. He sought the protection of the civil rights that he had as a Roman citizen through the Roman courts. And you'll notice also that his nephew told him, and Paul did his part. He called in the centurion that was responsible for his well-being and told him, you tell Claudius Lysias that this is going on. So there's a lot of things that Paul did on his own behalf to provide some satisfaction and protection for himself on this journey. So it's not all in the hands of Claudius Lysias. It was not all in the hands of Paul. It was not all in the hands of the brethren who prayed for him. And it was not all simply in the hand of God. God didn't perform a miracle. What we see here is people doing their jobs, doing what was intended for them to do in order that God might bless them. Now, my question to you as we close our study is, do you believe what God has said? You see, the point I'm trying to establish is you do your part. You pray about it, and then you trust that God will do His. Now, is there any reason to doubt God? No, don't want to doubt there. So, I'm going to quit with that. Have I got a few seconds left?
Oh, yeah.
55 whole seconds. Well, I don't want to start on the question yet, so I'm going to stop with that, and we'll pick up the questions next time.
Well, I think a lot of people will say, well, why did Paul use his Roman citizenship in this manner? You go, in the instances that he used it, it went to the furtherance of the gospel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's not wrong to use your citizenship. If that helps the kingdom of God.
That's right. You do what you can do. What's within your power, within your authority. All right. Thank you.